Bangkok session number 13939, Reel 2.
So, to continue, how long did you stay on the Falkland Islands after the cessation of hostilities? Were you there for a bit doing sort of
I left May, June, July. I left mid-August. Of course, the actual last battle was, if I remember correctly, was the 16th of June. So, I mean, the whole thing didn't take really very long. I was there for quite a long time after. It was... We were shifting all sorts of equipment, a lot of it's stuff that was being put on board ships to go home again, all sorts of army equipment. We moved considerable amounts of building materials around as various bases were set up. We moved probably several dozen porter cabins at various stages to locations all over the Falkland Islands. Once that was sort of complete, most of it was our usual work in support of the army. Usual routine stuff. One of the jobs we were quite often called upon to help with was rescuing BVs, which is it's like a large snow cap. It's two cabs on a tracked vehicle with a hydraulic steering mechanism, which is actually between the two vehicles. And in some of the appalling conditions, especially on the after the radar sites had been set up, the BVs quite often got bogged down in mud and peat and what have you, and it was usually quite an interesting task to try and fit the slinging equipment and lift them out. Usually the most difficult job was actually finding somewhere on the vehicle that was strong enough to attach the slings to, so that when we pulled it out, we didn't, you know, make didn't make any more damage than there already was. Mount Alice, which was the southern of the two radar sites, was built from materials that was lifted into place entirely by helicopter. Nothing went by road for that particular site. Everything went by helicopter. Which, when you consider the size of the site, was quite some feat. The Chinook is a very capable machine when it's working well, and I have to say, during the time that I was in the Falklands, the first time I was there, unserviceabilities were relatively few, major unserviceabilities. Yeah, we all have little snags that can be carried until the spare parts arrive, but for the most part, the aircraft seemed to enjoy being worked 10 hours a day, every day. We were accommodated in the sheep shearing sheds at Port San Carlos. We built bunks and partitioned it off ourselves. In fact, the locals, when we finally moved out, and one of the main reasons we moved out was they needed the sheds because it was shearing time. They had quite a job getting the sheds into a suitable state of repair in terms of ripping out all these bunks and partitions and everything that we put in, so they could actually use the sheds for its primary purpose. Conditions were, I suppose, fairly basic. For the most part, we lived on composite rations, but the morale generally was absolutely brilliant. Morale was very, very high, probably about 500% higher than it had any real right to be. We didn't have any civvies to start with, any civvy clothes. We wore either flying suits or jungle greens all the time, or olive greens rather than jungle greens. We used to start the machines up at daybreak and close them down at sunset, having not stopped all day. Rotors running refuels all day long, which is where you actually pump fuel in while the rotors are still turning. And 10 hour day was pretty standard. So that some days when you got back, it was fairly demanding work as well, physically as well as mentally demanding. And there were days when you got back to your home and all you wanted to do was eat and go to sleep. You were so tired. Knowing that you had to do it again tomorrow.
Was there much else to do anyway in your off time?
No. We used to show films. We had films, and we set up our own beer tent called the Goose and Brick. Because one of the regiment lads tried to kill one of the upland geese by throwing a half brick at it. He missed, of course, but it gave us a rather apt name for the pub, as we called it. The entertainment was whatever you chose to do yourself. Played a lot of cards. Probably drank too much.
You got mail, right?
Mail was fairly regular. The Herks, I have to say, I mean, I wasn't on them at that stage. The Herks were coming in and out of Stanley, having done what the air bridge, as we used to call it, and having flown down from Ascension on I flew home on a Herc to Ascension Island from Stanley, and then the next time I came back, which was 3 months later, I came down by Herc again, 13 hours in the back of Albert. It's no joke. But I have to say, the Herc crews were absolutely tremendous. I mean, some of the conditions that they were attempting landings and takeoffs in were quite appalling. And all praise must go to them. They kept the mail coming, and most of the supplies, major supplies, came by ship, of course, because of the distance and the amounts involved. But the Hercs brought essential stuff. They always brought the mail. They always seemed to get in. It's very rare that they actually turned around and had to go back without actually getting in. And usually they made several attempts. But I had a colleague of mine on Chinooks. He had the unfortunate experience of getting airborne from Ascension Island and 28 hours later landing back at Ascension Island, because they'd been down to Stanley. The weather was quite disgusting, and they hadn't been able to get in despite the best efforts of the Herc captain and his crew. It was just impossible, so they had to turn around and come back, because at that stage, of course, there was no friendly countries in South America who would have allowed them to land. So it was a matter of you got airborne out of Ascension Island, and several hours later you did an air-to-air refuel, and if you had to go back, you had to do the same again. So obviously the tanker had to be sent out from Ascension. Hard days, busy days, but for the most part enjoyable. The actual war itself, I can remember being on the deck of Norla one day and watching an A4 go over, and it was engaged by a sea skewer, I suspect. One of the older shipborne missiles, and we watched this missile take off from, I believe it was Antelope, and it was chasing it wasn't an A4, it was a Superintendard, and unfortunately the Encendar went in a reheat, and the aircraft in reheat was faster than the missile, and if willpower alone could have made that missile hit, then it would have hit, because everybody, I look round at the other crews and the other gun crews, and everybody in the deck's going, go on, get the bastard. Fortunately, that one got away that day.
Probably a Sea Dart, wasn't it? I think the Sea Skewer, isn't that mounted by helicopters for?
Yes, I think so. It was probably a Sea Dart. It was one of the older ones, not the more up to date. They were better. But I've been on board Antelope when I was on Primas in Belize. I'd actually spent a day on board the ship with the petty officers and having probably too much of a good time and a look around the ship. And I actually watched Antelope die in the water from several hits. And I remember thinking at the time, well, obviously it won't be the same crew that I knew, because there's quite a high, as I understand it, there's quite a high rate of turnover with ships' companies. But it was just the fact that I'd actually been on, that was the one, of all the vessels that were down there, that was the one that I'd actually been on board. And it was quite sad, really, to watch it go down. Fortunately, they got most of the crew off. But it was still a bit sad to watch, if you like, a friend just disappearing. Yeah.
On your second tour down there, were you doing much the same work again, carting building materials around and so on?
Yeah. It was, by that stage, I mean, the army were pretty well set up with companies in various locations, and we just used to go down and carry on the normal sort of emplaning, deplaning drills, practicing for various types of assault, and moving the light guns should the Argies, you know, have the audacity to come back again, which I think most of us suspected they wouldn't.
You were talking about your second
tour. Yes, the second tour was a bit of a shock, really, because having come back the first time, I had approximately, with accumulated stand down and leave and etc., I had basically a month off. And I went on holiday with my family, which I needed. I was... once I was able to relax, as it were, after the sort of the frantic lifestyle, certainly hard working lifestyle that I'd been leading for the past 3.5 months, and also been sat in Bomb Alley for 5 days and out at sea for best part of 6 weeks all in all, watching the Argies being shot down and our guys being hit, and I really wasn't looking forward to having to go back at all, and as far as I was aware, I wasn't going to. But when I got back to work, having had a month off, obviously 18 Squadron had come home from the Falklands by this stage, and finally managed to prepare themselves and go off to Germany, which is what they should have done 6 months earlier. And while I was on leave, 7 Squadron, as it was going to be called, had had an official reformation parade, and we had taken over the Falklands commitment. Unfortunately, of the 3 guys on the squadron who'd been down the first time, one was a flight engineer who went back to his primary job of being a flight engineer, not a helicopter crewman. He went to what he affectionately called a Kipper Fleet, Nimrods. The other loadmaster was starting resettlement leave and courses because he was retiring from the Air Force, which left me. So I was asked by the boss if I would mind going down again on the first detachment, just to show our lads the ropes, as it were, because I'd been there and knew how things worked. What sort of tasking we were doing, and So having been home exactly 3 months, I went back again for Christmas and New Year, 1982. So in the first year of the Falklands conflict and ongoing manning of the islands, if you like, I was there for 7 months.
Now Mount Pleasant hadn't been built by then, had it?
Mount Pleasant wasn't even in, I don't think it was even in anybody's mind at that stage.
Did you go back to the sheep sheds, or was it better?
No, when I got back, we were still at Port San Carlos, but we'd moved into tents on the green because obviously they needed the sheds for shearing. And we were 3 to a tent, 12 by 12 tent, that's 12 foot by 12 foot square. And there was, we had proper beds, metal bunk beds, you know, usual army style bunk beds, and reasonable bedding, but it was still pretty basic. The food, everything was done from tents, except the officers had a building, and the senior crew weren't in the bunkhouse. But later on, towards the end of that period, the crewman leader and the more senior crewman were given rooms in the shepherd's bunkhouse, which was sort of at the bottom of the green, and we used their facilities for washing and showering. But,
what about heating? Do you have plenty of that? Because it's pretty raw down there.
Heating consisted of paraffin heaters, which, I mean, paraffin heaters and tents don't always go together very well. We just had to make sure that the heater was turned off at night. I mean, the weather generally was completely changeable. You could start, I've seen a day where you wake up and it's 8/8 blue, it's a gorgeous day, and by mid-afternoon it's howling a gale, it's snowing, it's freezing cold. The problem being, of course, that between the Falklands and Antarctica there's nothing but sea, so if the wind's from the south, it brings all the cold weather screaming across the southern Atlantic and straight across the Falklands. So some days it was really pleasant, and other days it was freezing cold.
After the after your second tour, then you came home. Did you go onto Hercules?
After my second tour, I went down again the following year. Oh, was it 83 I came on? No, 84 I went again. And but only for 2 months this time. When I was down there that time, they started looking at an alternative for Stanley, because despite the best efforts of the Royal Engineers and the M2 planking they put down, with the heavy traffic that had been taken with the Hercs continually coming and going, the runway was starting to break up. Plus, FIGAS, the Falkland Islands Government Air Service, was starting to come back online again, and obviously they wanted to use Stanley themselves. The residents of Stanley wanted the Air Force and the Army away, you know, sort of out of their hair, as it were. So I suppose that was when they thought of building MPA. And I actually took the first team of Royal Engineers in to conduct the initial survey to find out where would be the best place to put. I don't know how long the runway is. I think it's in the region of about 8,000 feet. It's quite a large runway. And they decided that this area called Mount Pleasant, once it sifted, got through the, I believe it was about five or six feet of peat, there was reasonable bedrock below, which would make a suitable base for building not only a runway, but a fairly large establishment. And that was in 84. When I went back for my fourth tour in 86, I was now in Germany. MPA was built, finished, in use, because that's where I went to.
And how did you fly in then?
I still flew down. I flew down by Hercules to Stanley, and was and we were still using Stanley as the airhead, because the runway wasn't. Although the runway was, the runway open then? Yes, the runway was open, but they hadn't got a full movement set up. So they actually were still using Stanley as the air bridge, because they were using the government air terminal at the time.
And still doing air-to-air refueling on the way down?
Yeah. Mm. It was while I was there, during that 6 weeks period, that they started flying the TriStars in, because I went home prematurely in 1986, having been there 6 weeks. I went home by TriStar. Well, I was medevaced home, because I was involved in the 1986 crash where the Chinook flew into the hillside. And
were you in that? Yeah.
I was actually in. I was involved in that one. Yeah, I was one of the two crewmen.
What was that? Bad visibility or what?
We were overtaken by a snowstorm. As I remembered it, we were trying to get back into Mount Ellis to put the some of the Gurkhas back to their base. And excuse me. And we were travelling quite slowly. I thought we were trying to follow the BV tracks in relatively bad weather to get into Alice and sort of sit on the top and wait for the storm to pass over, which is, excuse me, what we used to do. If you got overtaken by a very large snowstorm, you just, the beauty of a helicopter, you can just land, find a suitable flat spot, land on and wait for it to pass and then carry on when the weather's a bit better. But on this particular instance, the storm was moving faster than we were, and in actual fact we crashed 5 miles northeast of Mount Ellis, and we'd actually hit a ridge line 50 feet from the top, straight level, doing 80 knots while the captain was attempting to transfer from visual to instrument flying. And by the time we'd done it, it was too late. We'd hit, and the aircraft was pretty much destroyed. The fuselage remained intact, but the cockpit was destroyed. The tail pylon came off. Both rotors obviously were severely damaged, and of the 16 on board, 13 of us managed to get out of it. Most of us with minor cuts and bruises.
Were you strapped in then?
Yes. Well, I wasn't personally, but that was standard practice for the number one loadmaster because of the frequent scan checks to do. But the Gurkhas, the 12 Gurkhas were all strapped in. The two pilots obviously were, and my colleague at the front was on harness. But unfortunately for them, because it was a horizontal rather than a vertical impact, all the seat belts flew open on the impact, and we all ended up in a heap in what would have been the cockpit had it still been there.
And they were killed in the cockpit.
The captain actually survived, to tell the tale. He's now got a false leg, right leg from the knee down, but he managed to survive. He was thrown clear of the aircraft, still strapped into his seat. So the seat was good, the mountings weren't, but the seat was good. And it was only the fact that this Gurkha, Bazunta Pun, tried to get Mike out of his seat that set off his PLB, and we were found, because otherwise I think we'd have all died.
Position, location, medium.
Yes. They always assume that if an aircraft crashes, that the crew are going to be able to do everything that you're supposed to do and look after the passengers and set off emergency equipment, set off your PLBs, get flares ready, etc., etc. In this particular case, the captain was unconscious, the co-pilot was buried, and it took them 5 hours to find him. The other crewman was dead as a direct result of the crash, and I was so incapacitated I couldn't do anything. I could hardly breathe, let alone think about setting off PLBs and flares and
looking after the president.
Well, I didn't know at the time, obviously, but it transpired later in hospital that I'd got a complete free section of ribs at the back, where three ribs had been broken in two places, if you understand. And the broken end of one of my ribs had punctured my lung, so I had a collapsed lung. My right thumb was completely and utterly smashed up, and my right leg was injured. I had a broken left shoulder blade. So I say I was hard pushed to complete a sentence, let alone tell anybody how to set off emergency equipment. Obviously very disorientated as well. Not a pleasant experience.
No.
But it was the sort of accident that could have happened, I suppose, any time from when we first started flying Chinooks down there, and even today, because we used to fly in some fairly bad weather, especially in the early days, because the mountaintop rebroadcast sites, which were manned by the army signallers, relied entirely on us for their existence. Without us, they didn't get rations. More importantly, they didn't get any fresh water. And probably even more importantly from their point of view, they didn't get any mail. So we used to fly in pretty bad conditions, obviously safely, or as safely as we could. There's no point in putting yourselves at risk. And on this particular occasion, the weather got the better of us. As I say, not an experience I would like to go through again, and hopefully I won't.
Not appropriately, it was your last visit down there.
Yes, I still had 2 years to run on my Germany tour, but I was offered the chance to leave immediately, to leave Chinooks, but I chose to stay, and I was off work for 5 months exactly, 5 months to the day. I went flying again, and I suppose it's like riding a bike. The first time you fall off, you've got to get back on again straight away, otherwise you're never going to ride a bike. And I suspect it was the same with me. By the time the 5 months were up, I'd been cleared by the medics, I was itching to get back flying again. Finished my tour in Germany, and then I came across to Herx.